This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
After all the months of talking and arguing and debating and town halling, we may finally be getting down to it in the healthcare debate. The last congressional committee working on a bill is set to make it public this week. We know roughly what's going to be in it and roughly how much it's going to cost. What we don't know yet is whether anyone can afford it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mass Mutual, sponsor of Retirement Revolution, airing on PBS tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Local listings at pbs.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today the 15th of September. Great to have you with us. So have you ever had one of those bosses where the last person to talk to her usually wins the argument? Drives you crazy, right? There is something similar happening with the healthcare debate in Washington. We have been waiting weeks for the Senate Finance Committee to stop talking and make up its mind. Chairman Max Baucus has said today he hopes to share what they've come up with tomorrow. Informed opinion is that that bill is going to become the basis for much of the negotiations to come. All five bills currently circulating in Congress would expand Medicaid for the poor, and they would provide subsidies to help low- and middle-income families buy coverage if they aren't insured at work. But premiums, as we all know, are only the beginning. There are co-pays and deductibles and other out-of-pocket costs. And when you add it all up, health care might still be too expensive for too many. From Washington, Marketplace's Tamara Keith has more.
Let's be clear. We're not talking about people who have insurance through their employer. We're talking about people who are uninsured or by their own insurance. Virtually everyone will be required to have coverage.
You could tell people they have to purchase health care, but you also better take steps to make sure it's affordable.
Ron Wyden is a Democratic senator from Oregon and a member of the Finance Committee. He says under the latest plan he's seen, even with assistance, a family of four earning $66,000 a year would still have to pay about 13% of their income in premiums.
You're going to have to pay $8,500 a year for your premium. Then you're going to have to pay more for your co-payments. You're going to have a big deductible. You're already walking on an economic tightrope.
And before long, we're talking about a real hardship. Peter Cunningham is a senior fellow at the Center for Studying Health System Change.
These reform proposals are not going to completely eliminate the financial pressures that families feel from health care, either their premiums or their out-of-pocket costs.
But Cunningham says millions of people will be better off than they are today. People like Stephen Tater and his family. He's self-employed, has two kids, and a wife with diabetes.
Close to a third of our total annual income was consumed by our health costs, largely premiums. And I got to be honest, I don't go to doctors because I can't afford it.
Linda Blumberg, an economist at the Urban Institute, says the family's annual medical expenses could drop to around 15% of their income, but not much less. She says Congress is under pressure to keep the price of an overhaul under $1 trillion.
The only way to pare that number back is by taking it out of either the benefits that are provided or the subsidies for the package you're providing.
Because health care isn't getting any cheaper. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
The corporate story of the day turns on finances as well. Kraft Foods wants to buy Cadbury, the British candy maker. The offer is almost $17 billion. Today, Kraft Denied reports it's going to have to unload Oscar Mayer, Maxwell House, or any of its other brands to pay for that deal. Joel Rose reports.
Kraft's offer for Cadbury is largely driven by its hunger to reach fast-growing international markets. That's according to Bob Golden, executive vice president of the food research firm Technomic.
Kraft has been looking to expand their presence outside the United States. Cadbury's strength is very much in Europe and other parts of the world.
Cadbury's business is especially strong in emerging markets, where chocolate sales are growing quickly, in contrast to the U.S. and Europe, where they're basically flat. Those international markets include India and other former British colonies.
Going back, way back, Cadbury was able to use its British connections to set up businesses in those markets.
Dean Best is the editor of the website JustFood.com, which covers the global food industry. After Kraft's offer was announced last week, there were rumors that Hershey or Nestle might get involved too. But so far, that hasn't happened. And for its part, Best says Cadbury has shown little appetite for a merger.
Cadbury has been adamant that it can survive on its own 2 feet, and they don't really see that combining with Kraft will enable the company to grow faster.
Best expects that Cadbury CEO will repeat that message in a conference call with analysts tomorrow. But if Kraft does come back with a better offer, especially one that's heavier on cash, Best says Cadbury's shareholders may find it too sweet to resist. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Credit card companies reported their August default rates today. They were a bit sour. Capital One and Discover saw around 9% of their balances go bad. Bank of America topped 14%. It all adds up to billions of dollars in losses. Add that to the new consumer protection laws that passed earlier this summer, and plastic is in a tight spot. So card companies are trying an interesting new tactic, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
You could call it a kinder, gentler generation of credit cards. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase unveiled the Blueprint card, which doesn't charge interest for day-to-day purchases like groceries. American Express's new ad campaign stresses the protections its cards offer.
If something you recently bought with the card breaks, it can be repaired, replaced, or your account can be credited.
And Discover has a card that rewards you for paying your balance on time. That's a whole lot of virtue from an industry that made a whole lot of money on vice.
Credit card issuers are certainly responding to the PR issues that they're facing.
Ron Shevlin is a banking products expert at Aite Group.
It's also a bit of a play from an issuer perspective to acquire new customers and keep the ones they've got, better long-term customers.
The pay-on-time customers they used to ignore. Robert Manning is author of Credit Card Nation. He says cash-strapped consumers who used to pay a fortune in interest are defaulting, and now card companies have to coddle higher-end clients.
They're hoping to basically consolidate that loyalty so when the economy improves, they will be the first customers that they'll start offering new loans and new lines of credit to.
And because plastic is no longer so profitable, card companies are expanding into new businesses. Capital One has been buying up banks to become a full-service financial firm. American Express just rolled out a new line of personal savings accounts. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Bank of America shares lost about 20 cents today, a percent or so from where it opened. From a year ago today, the day that not only Lehman Brothers went under, but also when B of A agreed to buy Merrill Lynch, B of A shares are off almost 37%. Elsewhere on Wall Street this Tuesday, quite a bit happier. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In 1932, Congress approved a commission to investigate what had happened to cause the Great Depression, to name names if it had to, and to propose fixes that would prevent another depression from ever happening again. After Lehman Brothers collapsed last year, we got about as close as we're hopefully going to get to another Great Depression. So this time, Congress didn't wait 3 years to start its investigation. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission holds its first official meeting on Thursday. Former California State Treasurer Phil Angelides is the chairman of that commission. Mr. Angelides, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
The broad outlines of this financial crisis and how it started are already known. What more can we expect to learn from you and your commission?
I think it's very important that the American people have the full picture of what led to the financial meltdown. I mean, our capital system almost collapsed. We now have 7 million jobs that have been lost since the financial meltdown began. Millions of people have lost their homes, and it's important as a nation that we do a full examination into the practices that brought us to the brink. It's elementally important that we understand because, in fact, those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. And I think there's a lot of folks who are hoping that they can get back to business as usual, but we can't afford that as a country.
I want to get back to that point in just a second, but let me ask you this. Can we expect you to name names and cast blame and say it was this company's fault and these people's fault and they sold these products and that was damn near criminal?
You know, people have asked me if there's going to be embarrassing instances here. I mean, the fact is we will pursue facts. And if the facts turn out to be embarrassing or if they turn out to be criminal, so be it. But I do think it would minimize our inquiry if all it was about finding 20 or 30 people who broke the law. This was a widespread phenomenon in terms of what happened in this country. Some of the practices that were engaged in, I think it's important to note, were not only permitted, but they were applauded and exalted. So I think we'll be looking at the whole range of behavior.
Let me get back to that point about the banks thinking that they can go back to business as usual. You know, the president yesterday, when he was talking on Wall Street, said in essence the same thing, that these banks are making these loans and refinancing and repackaging more mortgages. How can we believe that banks and Wall Street aren't going to keep on doing the same thing, even though your commission is trying to get to the bottom of this?
Well, I do think that this is about changing values and culture over time. And, you know, change starts with a recognition of what's happened in the past. It's a little bit like, you know, someone who has been a drinker, a smoker, a bad eater, who then has a heart attack. You know, some people take it to heart and begin to diagnose what went wrong and change their behavior. Others go back to just doing the same old thing. If you will, if our commission's work is done right, we will be an antidote, not the antidote, to the quick return of egregious practices.
Congress is expected to take up financial reform this fall. The president said he wants something by the end of the year, yet your report isn't due until the end of next year, December of 2010. Do we have to wait for you and your commission before we can really figure out how to change the rules?
No, I think people can move on parallel tracks. As we do our public hearings, our investigation, more facts will come to light. And the president and the Congress ought to take those into account. When we produce our final report, hopefully they will see things in our final report that will be a call to further action. But in any event, no matter whether they pick structure A or structure B for regulation, because, you know, in the end, we did have regulators. They just didn't do their jobs. In the end, hopefully our history will be a guidebook for regulators and people in the markets.
Phil Angelides, he's the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. They're set to have their first public meeting on the 17th. That's Thursday. Mr. Angelides, thanks so much for your time.
Terrific. Thank you so much for having me with you.
The criticism that Ben Bernanke, Henry Paulson, and Timothy Geithner have gotten for letting Lehman Brothers go under a year ago. Their best line of defense is actually a pretty obvious one. We're not really in another Great Depression now, are we? Former Treasury Secretary Paulson's book isn't due out for another couple of months. The current secretary and the Fed chairman won't write theirs until they leave office. But commentator David Skeel says the worst of Lehman's after effects may be yet to come.
Letting Lehman go while propping up AIG and Citigroup was supposed to keep the market honest without letting the banking industry go down the tubes. A little tough love would teach the managers of our financial behemoths to be better citizens by making clear that they can't count on Uncle Sam to bail them out if they fail. No more wild risk-taking or bank misbehavior. But Wall Street may well be less honest after Lehman, not more. Here's why. Before the crisis, the vast market in sophisticated financial contracts called derivatives was controlled by a few financial institutions, known on Wall Street as the 14 families. Scratch one of these contracts, and you could be sure that one of the families was the buyer, the seller, or both. If any of these giants collapsed, the whole house of cards might come down. With Lehman gone, the little oligarchy of banks still dominates Wall Street, but the clique is a little bit smaller. This may be the worst possible outcome for the future of our financial markets. worse even than bailing out every one of the banks or letting them all fail. If the whole system had gone down, we'd at least have the chance to rebuild a better one. But with fewer giants, there is even less competition on Wall Street than before the crisis. The banks in the now smaller club are even more likely to do what monopolists always do, fight transparency and protect their own profits at the expense of small businesses and consumers. And with fewer but much bigger giants, it will be even harder for regulators to avoid bailing any one of them out if it fails, no matter how badly their managers behave. Before the crisis, four or five of them were probably too big to fail. Now, they all are. I never thought I would say I miss Lehman. But as I look out on the new Wall Street landscape, same as the old one, except worse, I'm tempted to put a few flowers on Lehman's financial grave.
David Skeel is a professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, selling sausages like they were hotcakes.
We couldn't believe the opening day. We couldn't believe making $700. The original model I built was for 25 sausages per day.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 56 points today, 0.5%, closed at 9,683. The NASDAQ gained 10 points, 0.5%, settled at 2102. The S&P 500 grabbed 3 points, 0.3%. Wrapped up at 1,052. Encouraging reports on manufacturing boosted industrial shares today. Alcoa jumped 8%. General Electric lit up 4%. Caterpillar piled on 6%. Copper producer Freeport-McMoRan gained 1% today. Worsening consumer credit dinged other financial stocks. Capital One dialed back 2.33%. JPMorgan Chase slipped 1.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.45%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis, the new book by Bill George from Josie Bass Publishers. Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis is available in bookstores everywhere. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department releases its monthly consumer price index, letting us know how much folks in urban areas are paying for goods. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper meets with President Obama at the White House. Discussion is expected to focus on the economy and the war in Afghanistan. And a House subcommittee on rural development, entrepreneurship, and trade holds a hearing on the economic impact of auto dealer closings on local communities. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Poor countries have been among the hardest hit by the global recession, in part because they can't really afford the bailouts and the stimulus packages that others can. For those who want to help, it might be beneficial to think about targeting your aid to women and girls in particular. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and his wife, journalist Cheryl Wu Dunn, wrote about that in their new book. It's called Half the Sky. And Nick Kristof explained why women can be the key to lifting families and even whole communities out of poverty.
You simply can't develop an economy if you're only using half of your human resources. And a second factor is that when you educate people and they have higher earning capacity, then and I'm a little embarrassed as a guy to admit this, but men are more likely to spend their higher earnings on things like alcohol, tobacco, while women, when they have higher earning power, there are a whole bunch of studies that show that they're more likely to use that money to invest in their kids and to start small businesses.
Is it more, though, Cheryl, than just building schools and getting girls in classes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, education is the beginnings of a foundation, but it's not a panacea. It really has to be that the women have to be welcomed into the formal labor force. Their resources can really convert the household economy, the local village economy, the county economy, and then if you aggregate it all up, the national economy.
And one of the things, Cheryl, that you guys key on in this book, and others have as well, is this phenomenon of microfinance, small loans and building small businesses that way. Why is it so targeted at women so successfully?
You know, the dirty little secret of poverty is not so much that they don't bring in income. It's that they don't spend well. And Nick talked about how men spend versus women spend when they control the household purses. The same goes for lending, how money is deployed. So women, when they get microloans, the women meet in groups and they've pooled their money and lend it to one of the women. And women tend to come up with very inventive ideas. For instance, one of the women we talk about in the book started an embroidery business, and she was really good at it. When she couldn't fill the orders from the merchants, she actually started hiring everyone else in the village, and she became the local tycoon.
How does economic empowerment, Nick, turn to social empowerment and then eventually, I imagine, political rights?
The woman that Cheryl mentioned in Pakistan, who had been a beneficiary of microfinance, she got a $65 loan that she used to build up her embroidery business. And until she got that embroidery business going, her husband was beating her every day. He didn't particularly want to educate her two daughters, and he was thinking about getting a second wife on the thought that the second wife might bear him sons. And then because his wife was bringing in money and helping to support the household, he really was forced to see women in a new light. And you began to see values changing not only in that household, but in the broader village.
You know, Nick, these women have obviously decided to take responsibility for themselves, to get themselves out of their situation and do what they can. Who else is responsible for helping these women and these girls? Is it local governments, aid groups, Western countries?
I'd say all of the above. You know, certainly local governments should be doing much, much more. But the point is that whether or not those other actors do the things that they should, we can take various steps that will truly make a difference for girls or women around the world.
This book is advocacy journalism. You are openly advocating that we as a society take up the cause of these women. What can we do?
If you have $1 million, of course you can do a lot. If you have $7, you can go and pay for school supplies for a girl in Cambodia to continue school for a year. That means a lot to that girl. Decide what your foe is. Do you care more about sex trafficking? Do you care about maternal mortality? Do you care about violence against women? Choose your foe. And then choose the country that you want to be involved with. Finally, choose your organization. Choose your partner. Which organization would you like to work with? You know, you just browse 15 minutes in each of those steps and you can come up with a good start.
The most recent book by Cheryl Wu Dunn and Nicholas Kristof is called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Kai.
Maybe it's just me because I hear this show every day, but it seems like we are constantly bringing you news of businesses that are struggling to get by. So how about something completely different today? A success story from an industry where it is notoriously tough to break even. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Caitlin Cowrell reports that good ideas can sizzle even when the economy cools.
A line snakes around the block in a gritty part of Los Angeles. Hipsters, families, and tourists are all waiting to get into a restaurant whose name they can't even pronounce.
Worskuchi.
Worskucha.
Yeah, Worskucha.
Worskucha.
The name isn't the only unusual thing about Worskucha, German for sausage kitchen. Last fall, as many other restaurants were closing, Joseph Petroselli and his cousin Tyler Wilson were opening Worskucha for fries, beer, and oh yeah, sausage.
Well, we've got 22, I think, in the case today. And they range from traditional like bratwurst and bockwurst and into the exotics like the rattlesnake and rabbit, buffalo beef and pork.
Worskucha also offers an array of international beers and Belgian fries. but there's nothing exotic about the restaurant's business plan. The menu is simple and pretty cheap, and the cousins know how to contain labor costs. Here's Tyler Wilson describing his cousin.
Joseph can work harder than anybody you've ever met, and longer, and all the time.
Like, even if I'm out to dinner, like, I still go look through their kitchen.
It's hard to tell if First Cuca even has a kitchen when you walk in. It looks like just a takeout counter, but turn the corner and a hallway leads you to a football field-sized room filled with long communal tables.
You walk in and the place is so small, and like the line will be at the door, and then they'll walk around this and they'll go, oh my God.
The cousins had a few oh my God moments of their own last fall.
We couldn't believe the opening day. We couldn't believe making $700. The original model I built was for 25 sausages per day.
Now Verst Cuca often turns out 800 sausages a night. The business is growing fast, and everyone has an opinion about how to manage it.
Every time he sees me walk in, I think he cringes a little bit.
Chris Haar teaches entrepreneurship studies at the University of Southern California. Wilson was one of his students. When he told him he wanted to open a restaurant, Haar reminded him of the risk. More than half of restaurants fail in the first 3 years.
A lot of restaurants will start off with good momentum. The trick is to keep that going in years 3, 4, 5, and 10.
The cousins, both in their 20s, are still focused on making it through year one. They're busy spreading the word on food blogs and social networks. They also tell everyone they meet about their restaurant. Entrepreneurship expert Barry Moltz says it's all about building buzz.
The most important things people need to do is go out and find customers right away. I find that many entrepreneurs spend far too much time thinking about it, writing their business plan.
Verst Cuca is on track to make $3 million this year, but Petroselli still watches every dime, following the advice of a family friend who's built his own successful business.
He just goes, Petroselli, be a lean cat in lean times. And then, you know, and it makes sense to me, and I get it, and that was my lesson, and then, you know, I know where to go from there.
Wherever that is, Petroselli and Wilson know the worst is behind them. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
If all that made you hungry for a good grilled sausage, well, at least Caitlin took some pictures while she was out reporting that story. You're on your own for the beer, too. Sorry about that. You can check our website for the pictures. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, one that may or may not make you feel any better. Ben Bernanke gave a speech today, said the usual macroeconomic things Fed chairmen say, and then he took some questions, one of which was, so, Mr. Chairman, how's the economy doing? The transcript of his answer runs five paragraphs, count them five. Here's the meat of it, though.
Even though, from a technical perspective, the recession is very likely over at this point, it's still going to feel like a very weak economy for some time.
So to recap, recession over, unemployment probably going over 10% by next year, the Fed says. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 56 points. That's 0.5%. The NASDAQ rose 10 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 scooped up 3 points, 0.3% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, when art is less about beauty and more about the bucks.
I'd go to an art museum and I couldn't enjoy the art anymore. I just look at a Mark Rothko or something and say, God, that's worth $10 million.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.